Welcome to the Hamilton Spectator Newsroom Insider Podcast. I'm health reporter Joanna Frikatich. In this episode, we'll speak to columnist Susan Claremont about an opportunity for the public to take part in a unique photo project called Left Behind. This special spectator project is the result of an outpouring of emotion that resulted from Susan's column about a 20-year-old woman who jumped off a bridge onto Highway 403 and died. Susan was overwhelmed by the responses from readers. Many wanted to share their own stories of loved ones who died by suicide. Susan will talk about how the Spectator is giving Hamiltonians the chance to tell their stories on August 2nd and 3rd here at the Spectator Auditorium. Next, we'll talk about why some people are willing to take chances that could result in injury or death, while others are risk-averse. Reporter John Wells will be with us to talk about this fascinating story and the surprising answers he found. Finally, we'll be joined by Spectator reporter Natalie Patton to discuss her investigative reports into the Hamilton Waterfront Trust and the issues her stories raise about transparency and accountability. Thanks for listening. Up next, Susan Claremont. I'm here with Spectator columnist Susan Claremont to discuss a special photo project called Left Behind. Thanks for joining us, Susan.
Thanks, Joe.
I understand there's a moving story behind this project. Can you talk about how it came about?
Yeah, this started with a really long story that I wrote and was in the paper a few weeks ago now about a young woman named Nicole Patnode. Nicole was 20 years old and mentally ill, and she jumped off a bridge and died by suicide. And the response that I got to this story is really unlike anything else I've ever had with any story I've written. I was just overwhelmed with beautiful responses from readers. And many of those people wanted to tell me their own stories about family members or loved ones who had died by suicide. And they were actually asking me to tell their stories. And I just, there were so many, I could never tell all of those stories. And that's where the idea for this photo project came about, is finding a way to honor these people and the loved ones that they've lost.
And as a columnist, you must often write stories that get big reactions. So can you talk about, you know, how this compares and what about this reaction sort of makes it different for you?
I've written stories about suicide before. Other long stories where families have shared very personal recollections of loved ones who've died by suicide. And in the past, when I've written these sorts of stories, they've been met with some mixed reviews, mostly people thanking me for starting a conversation about suicide, but some criticism too about how, this is private stuff and there's no place in a paper for stories about suicide. But I think things have really evolved over the years. Society's evolved. Our conversation about suicide has evolved. And this time, it was almost unanimously positive, the reaction that I got to Nicole's story. And that really told me a lot about how far we've come in this discussion and our attitudes.
Do you think it speaks a bit to stigma or a more ability to talk about mental health in general? Because I'm assuming many of these stories are really stories about mental health and the mental health care system.
Absolutely. That was all part of Nicole's story. Her struggle with mental health issues, her attempts to get well, her interaction with the healthcare system for better and sometimes for worse. So that's also elicited a great response from readers. Many people talking about their own struggles with mental illness and what the healthcare system has been able to do for them or where it's lacking. And so that's all part of this discussion about suicide.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a bit about the project, like the details of how someone can see it and what will be in it?
So the project is called Left Behind, and it's a photo project where we're inviting people who have lost someone to suicide to come to the Spectator to bring a photograph of the person they've lost and something that belonged to that person, as well as a little 50-word write-up about with the person's name and their age and an explanation of that item that they're bringing. And then we're going to Spectator photojournalist Gary Yokoyama is going to do a portrait photo of each of these people. And no story. I'm not writing a story, but I will be there to meet with people and talk with people and help Gary. And eventually, all of these portraits will be published in the Spectator.
And what are you hoping that night will be about? You know, what are you hoping when you have this, when all these people are together? What are you sort of hoping will come out of that?
Yeah, the focus of this is not about how people died, it's about how they lived. And that's the idea behind bringing something that belonged to the person who has died. You know, I'll give you a good example. One woman who read the story about Nicole and has told me that she's going to be a part of the Left Behind project told me a really touching story about her sister who died by suicide. Her sister had a great love of dancing, but she was not well and couldn't go out dancing and was seeking hospital care. And her sister told her, you know, we'll get you better and then you and I are going to go dancing. And so the sister who died went out and bought herself a fancy pair of shoes, a pair of dancing shoes that she never wore. She set them aside waiting for the day when they would get to go dancing. And sadly, that day never came. But those pair of shoes will be part of our project.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about what you hope readers will get out of this project eventually? You know, when it's published, what would you like to see this project bring about, or what message would you like to see it have?
I think when we see the faces of those who are left behind, I think what we'll learn is that this is everybody. This is all of us. This is our neighbor. This is our coworker. We're going to see, you know, old people, young people, people from every walk of life who have had suicide touch their lives. And I think we're also going to be surprised at the number of people. You know, I think we tend to think that this happens to somebody else or happens somewhere else, but this is happening in our community all the time, and the faces that Gary's going to photograph will reflect that.
And so if you're somebody who is interested in taking part, do you have to sign up in advance or call you, or, you know, what would you say to someone who's thinking about taking part?
You don't have to sign up, but what you do need to know is that it's happening this week here at the Hamilton Spectator at 44 Frid Street, and we're setting up a portrait studio in our auditorium on Wednesday. We start on Wednesday, and there'll be two sessions. One is from 1 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the other is from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., and then we do it again on Thursday from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. So hoping that you know, that people will come during those times and say hello to me, mm-hmm. and have your picture taken.
That's great. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joanna.
Joining us now is Spectator reporter John Wells to talk about why some people take chances with decent odds of injury or death while others are risk averse. Thanks for being here, John.
Great to be here, Joanna.
Well, this is a fascinating issue. Can you talk about what prompted this story?
Well, basically, I guess, you know, in the news recently, the accidents at the waterfalls around the city, and, you know, sort of this whole sense of what prompts people to ignore the warnings that are being posted and the fences being put up and the city escalating their bylaw enforcement, that sort of thing. So Paul Burton, our editor, asked me to do a piece about risk-taking and why certain people throw caution to the wind like that.
And where do you start? You know, when you get an assignment like that, where do you start? Like, where do you go for information?
I sort of have my own little mantra on these things is, what can I read? Who can I talk to? And where can I go? And the last one is the most fun part of the job is, you know, where can I go? What is there a piece of geography that I could see? Is there something I can experience to bring color to the story? So it was obvious to me that a waterfall would be a place to go to. So a nice hot summer afternoon, a good time to go and see a waterfall. So I went to Webster's Falls just to see if I could spot someone doing something foolish, basically, which, you know, feels sort of odd. You're just sort of waiting for someone to break the rules and certainly not hoping for someone to hurt themselves, but just looking for someone to do something risky. And so as soon as I got there, sure enough, people are hopping the fence. There's a sign right there that says caution, steep cliffs, you know, no climbing fence. And people are hopping over to take selfies. And so I got out the iPhone, was taking pictures of people climbing the fence and then talked to folks there about why they're doing what they were doing. And they were quite open about it. And so that's how I began, basically. And then also at the same time, interviewing a couple of academics about risk taking in terms of the science behind it, you know. In terms of the genetics and psychology and evolution even. And then basically tried to sort of weave that all together into one piece.
And when you went down to the waterfall, I'm not surprised it didn't take you very long to find some people trying to climb the fences. But yes. What kind of answers did you get when, you said the people were quite willing to talk to you? What kind of answers did they give you?
One of the young women who climbed the fence to take a selfie with her boyfriend, I think, they had their back to the gorge. You know, if they took a couple of steps backwards, you know, they would have fallen and been seriously hurt or died. It's high up there. She said it was an adrenaline rush. They hop the fence, they can get a better shot, a better picture. And so that was her answer. You know, it was interesting. I watched several young teenagers crawling under the fence. Someone had sort of dug out a bit of a trench under the fence to crawl under. And there was one girl who was 13 who she hung back and she didn't go. And I talked to her briefly, and I didn't have room for her in the story, but she was actually visiting from New Zealand, visiting cousins in Toronto, and they'd all come to see the waterfalls in Hamilton, which is cool. But her friends all went under the fence, and I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "Well, you know, they all want to get a good picture for Instagram, but to me, it's not worth risking my life." And I thought, no, there's a mature person, has a good head on her shoulders, kind of thing. So I got a bit of both. I mean, you know. People are, as one of the psychologists who I talked to in the story talked about, people are making sort of subconscious calculations of risk and trying to balance it off. And to those folks, climbing the fence, walking down the trail down to the gorge is not sufficiently risky, that it's going to deter them from doing it. And on the face of it, it's not. I mean, I didn't see anyone walking out across the falls or, you know, climbing on a tree or something crazy. I may well, I thought about going down into the gorge as well, although the fence is a bit high and I don't want to break my ankle just hopping the fence kind of thing. I don't think it is a high risk. And for them, that's how they see it as well, I guess.
And what were some of the biggest factors between the people who are willing to, you know, hop that fence and, you know, the girl from New Zealand who says, you know, that's not worth it to me? What did you find were the biggest factors to separate those two?
Yeah, I think certainly gender is a factor. I mean, it's borne out in the statistics that more men are injured and die from risk-taking activities, than women, and young males especially. And you know, a couple of the psychologists I talked about the evolutionary trait that men have in terms of trying to impress women for a mate. And you know, not to take that too far. I mean, you know, it's not really a conscious thing, but that's kind of part of that. And then also the other factor is age. The young. And not even so, maybe not so much the young as younger and unattached people who have who don't have the emotional attachment, say, that being in a serious relationship, a marriage, or to take it a step further, kids, that acts as a deterrent on risk taking. And you know, the experts I talked to talked about that you know, you get, and you know, men, young men in a group, the group setting escalates it, and I saw people in groups hopping the fence, and then one person's like, well, you coming? Oh, okay, sure, I'm coming. It's sort of common sense. That these are all things that go into that risk taking mix. And then when people get into stable relationships, have kids, they're less inclined at least to do that. And the one academic told me, and when people fall out of a relationship, then they're more inclined to take risks.
Wow. And what did you find most surprising when, you know, they were talking to you about why people do these things? What was the most surprising finding?
I think the hardwiring aspect, or the genetic component, is always something that I find fascinating, because to me it all sort of gets at the notions of a free will and why we do what we do and how much of it is a conscious decision that we make. And you know, I found it fascinating looking online. It's you know, some videos of experiments with this mouse in this lab, and the mouse had been engineered to have only one of these two genes that that promote our caution, basically. And so this mouse was climbing up on a high ledge, throwing caution to the wind, because he'd been engineered that way. And so, you know, there are studies that say that, you know, 30% of people are born without this particular with lower concentrations of this protein being produced by this gene. That means they need to seek a higher level of sensation, thrill-seeking sensation, to get that base level of sensation conventional people are feeling. And so I just, you know, that makes you sort of think about yourself and how you've behaved or acted, or the impulses you have over the years, and how much of that is something that you choose and how much is chosen for you. And I always find that quite fascinating.
And I understand that summer is a more risky time of year. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I used a line in the story. It's actually, it's quite an old quote that I gathered from doing some work in the ER at Hamilton General, you know, years ago. But it's something that's always stuck with me, and I have no reason to believe that nurses still don't use this phrase that they talked about summer being trauma season. Mm-hmm. You know, that they'll, you know, you know well, you know, nurses, how they use some dark humor and so on to cope with what they're seeing, and that, you know, that's the way they would talk. Oh, here we are, it's time for trauma season, car accidents. And I remember nurses saying, oh, you know, people are out there killing themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we tend to think of wintertime as being a dangerous time for driving cars, when in fact most of the fatalities occur in the summertime. People are driving fast, it's that short season, it's that adrenaline rush, everyone feels it, windows down, music playing, everyone's got somewhere to go in a hurry, and you're excited to get there. And so part of what's going on with the waterfalls and so on, as I said in the story, is, you know, there's opportunity, it's summertime. The waterfalls are beautiful. People are hearing about them more and more. They're coming increasingly. And so you get that sort of perfect storm, I think, where, you know, people might be more inclined to kind of push a little bit, given the season and all of that.
And I understand that in the story you talk a bit about your own personal, you add sort of a personal story to it. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I debated on, as I always do with sort of pieces like this, you know, do I bring myself into it? Do I have something amusing to tell, or something like that? And it just reminded me of the fascination I had with Evel Knievel, the daredevil motorcycle rider, when I was a kid. I asked for the Evel Knievel stunt jumper motorcycle toy for Christmas for years, and never received it. But that's another story. But anyway, I told the story that I had a buddy named PJ who lived across the street from me. I was probably 8 or 9 years old or whatever, and PJ was a huge fan of Evel Knievel as well. We'd watch him on TV, ABC's Wide World of Sports, jumping over buses and cars and crashing, and always coming back and doing it some more. And so we were both huge fans of his, and we came up with this idea. I'm not sure which one of us. PJ was maybe a year or two younger than me, and we came up with an idea that PJ would ride his bicycle, and we'd make a ramp on the street, and he would jump over piles of bricks. And this seemed like a great idea. And in turn, we would invite friends from around the neighborhood to come and watch. So we did this, and PJ wiped out a few times, you know, jumping over the bricks, and people were amazed, and he would do it again. And so I just wrote the story about how I I kept my feet firmly on the ground and acted as the promoter of the event. You know, with all my these cautionary genes flowing through my brain, kind of thing. And so I ended up the storytelling that little anecdote, and then it reminded me of this great moment. On this, there's a sports talk radio host in the U.S. named Jim Rome, and he had Evel Knievel on as a guest near the end of his life, and he asked Evel. He said, you know, one of the most famous stunts he did was trying to jump a rocket powered cycle across the Snake River Canyon in Idaho, and it almost killed him, and he thought he had a 50-50 chance of survival. And so Jim Rome, who's a very colorful host, and he said, well, Evel, you know, you had a coin's flip chance of buying it, of dying, so why do it? And Evel sort of paused this perfect one beat, and he said, you know who the hell I am? And that was the end of the interview, kind of thing. So I found the interview, it's on YouTube, and so I posted a link to that interview on there. And to me, there was the philosophical thing. I mean, it's just Evel Knievel spouting, but do you know who I am? And that's a deep comment, I thought. So I thought I would end off the story with my old hero, Evel Knievel.
Mm-hmm. And when you were talking to the experts or to the people at the waterfalls, did you get any idea of what is the best solution to this? I know that's something that Hamilton is really struggling with right now. You know, they have the bylaw out, giving people tickets or whatever. You know, did you get any sense of what is the best solution to sort of allow people to, you know, enjoy what we are, the city of waterfalls? We'd love it. Makes me so happy to hear people from Toronto come up to see them, but at the same time, you know, to keep people safe. So did you get any idea of what's the best way to do that?
That's sort of the tough one. You know, I was at council filling in for Matt Van Donder recently, and they were talking about, you know, the mayor talked about not wanting to sort of overreact on this, right? Mm-hmm. And I write about that in the story, that, you know, there does need to be a balance on that. You know, you can go overboard. I mean, you're putting up walls or fences, and all of a sudden you've taken away the ability of people to enjoy the waterfalls, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I didn't explore too much of solutions to the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, increasing the signage and having, you know, more bylaw officers or police presence is always going to help. At the same time, I think the people who are predisposed to want to push the envelope are going to do it. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I don't, you know, I write in the story a little bit about how the pendulum can swing too far the other way, and we become terrified of things in disproportion to how risky they are. And this has happened. You know, this, you could argue that's the case with things like flying or terrorist attacks or whatever. That these are things that can become highly publicized. You know, sort of when the waterfall stories become a big story in the paper, and rightly so. But if the pendulum swings sort of too far, then it can become a you know, there can be an overreaction to it. You know, I think you know, the city is doing what it can in terms of trying to increase the awareness. Certainly, we're doing our part, I think, in terms of publicizing it. At the same time, I think the people who are reading stories like this and are interested in it are probably the type of people who are already fairly cautious to begin with.
Yes.
And the ones who are going out walking across the waterfalls probably aren't taking the time to study up on risk taking. You know, and so I think they're always going to be in our midst. And there's not a lot you can do about that.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating story. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Joe.
I'm here with Spectator reporter Natalie Patton to talk about the issues she's been uncovering about the Waterfront Trust. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you have had some great revealing investigative stories this week in the paper. Can you sort of sum up your findings?
So far we've had two stories. The first one was talking about how the Waterfront Trust is hundreds of thousands of dollars behind in taxes. So it's $325,000 between their two properties, which is the Hamilton Waterfront Trust Center, where Sarcoa was, and the building just a little ways down the road where Williams is. And those taxes are owed from 2016 and 2017, and they recently made a payment within the past, you know, 6 weeks or so of about $170,000, which were taxes owed from 2015. And then the other story is about the trust having its charity status annulled by Canada Revenue Agency in November 2016, but up until Wednesday of this week, it's still said on their website that they were a charitable organization.
which really I think speaks to some transparency issues that your stories have really revealed. Can you talk a bit about transparency and accountability when it comes to this story?
Yeah, so I guess to start, you know, I'll give you a sense of what having a charity status annulled means. So it's something that Canada Revenue Agency does. A charity cannot ask to have their status annulled. It has to be initiated by CRA. And what it means is one of two things. It means that either the charity should never have been registered as a charity in the first place because it doesn't fit the criteria, or it means that the laws have changed since that charity was registered and it now no longer fits the rules. So in this case, it was that they never should have been registered as a charity in the first place. They were registered in 2004.
Which is a long time.
Yep. So it was about, you know, 12 years that that they were a registered charity. And so having charitable organization still on their website, you know, more than 2 years after the annulment process began, more than 2 years after CRA notified them and said they were looking into this, a couple experts that we spoke to raised some questions around this, around transparency, as you mentioned, and around the fact that one expert said, you know, it's misleading the public because when someone makes a donation to a charity, they can get a tax receipt. Well, that's not the case if you're a not-for-profit or, you know, any other kind of organization. So, and another expert we spoke to said that news of the annulment really should have been made public to the community and also to donors, which in what we have discovered wasn't really done. Councillor Jason Farr, who sits on the Waterfront Trust board, said it was discussed at a board meeting, and those board meetings are open to the public, but he didn't believe anyone was at that meeting. And board minutes, while they are accessible at the Waterfront Trust location, are not posted on their website. So it would be work for someone to find out that this had happened if they didn't know.
And did you get a sense at all of, you know, why it took so long to detect this and how it was detected finally, I guess, 2 years ago?
Yeah, by CRA. So CRA detected this through an audit of their books, the 2012-2013 books. And basically what they found was that the trust wasn't doing exclusively charitable activities. So they run businesses. They run William's Fresh Cafe, Scoops, the ice cream place down there. And that did not fall within the realm of a charitable organization. And so the CRA basically said it was on them for having registered the trust as a charity in the first place. But when the trust applied for charity status in 2004, CRA noted that they already had plans to run William's Fresh Cafe, and whether that had actually been executed yet or not was sort of unclear. But, I mean, those plans were kind of in motion that would have seen their activities not fit into the category of exclusively charitable.
And can you talk about, you know, why it is significant to report these stories? You know, why this is a significant story?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one important thing to note is that when a charity has its status annulled, it doesn't mean any wrongdoing. It wasn't revoked. But as you mentioned earlier, and as a couple of the experts that we spoke to mentioned, I think it's the issue of transparency. I mean, if we didn't have the time and the resources to look into this, people wouldn't know. And I know the trust has said, and CRA said too, that you know, the trust doesn't receive a heck of a lot of donations. So, you know, I'm sure not a lot of people were out there being misled, if any, about the fact that, you know, they were making donations to a charitable organization or not a charitable organization. But yeah, it really was a question of transparency. And I know in speaking to Councillor Jason Farr, he said that it was a question of them just not updating their website, not having the time or being distracted with other issues they have going on. But I mean, it's not a question of, it's not like they didn't update the business hours on their website. Not updating that you're a charitable organization does have an impact for people who want to donate or for people's perception of the agency. So it's, I do think it is something the public should know and should be aware of, especially because, you know, at this point, more than $300,000 in public money is going to this agency each year.
And getting back to the money, can you talk about, you know, the significance of the story about the taxes?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think based on feedback we've heard from that story, too, is that people are a little perplexed because if anyone, if, you know, you or I didn't pay our taxes, that would be an issue. And so this has been a couple of years that the trust has not been paying their taxes. And, you know, two city councilors sit on the board of the agency that have not been paying their taxes. And yeah, I mean, they say that paying their taxes is a priority among many. Those others include running services at the waterfront and also the legal fees that they have been accruing over the past couple years since they've been locked in this $15 million legal battle with Sarcoa and the cities involved in that as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to the issue of people wonder, you know, why, how has the trust gotten away with this when, you know, they feel like maybe you or I wouldn't? I mean, it does take a while for something like a tax sale to happen. It's not like, you know, we're at that point yet. But yeah, I think it's just a sort of that, that again, that transparency, transparency questions.
And when you get a story like this, when you sort of find out about a story like this, how do you go about landing that story? How do you go about getting that information?
So for the charity status bit of information, I mean, obviously we went to the website, saw that they're still calling themselves a charitable organization. And you can actually search quite a bit of information on Canada Revenue Agency. So you can type in the name of the charity and it will show you its current status. In this case, it says annulled. And typically, if a charity is still registered, you can get quite a bit of information about that charity from the site because they have to submit financial information annually, and it sort of breaks down revenue, expenses, employees. So that's sort of the way that we went about the charitable status side of things. And then taxes, you can go online and order tax certificates for properties in the city, and it shows you know, how much they pay on an annual basis. And we also confirmed that information with the city's tax director to make sure that we're reading this correctly. Yes. And we understand, and to make sure that you know, everything is up to date from our side of things. There hasn't been a lag in the system or something for a payment made. So,
and can you talk about what the Waterfront Trust is and what it does?
Yeah, so it's an arm's length agency. It was created in 2000, and it actually came out of a settlement of a lawsuit between the city and the Hamilton Harbor Commission, which no longer exists now, the Port Authority. And that settlement resulted in $6.3 million in seed money that the trust was overseeing to use to bring Hamiltonians to the waterfront, really. That's their mandate. And so they're in charge of, you know, the recreational activities down there. They've got the rink and whatnot. Then there's Williams and, you know, the Hamilton Waterfront Trust Center, which is where Sarcoa was. So they, yeah, but they are arm's length. So they're not, they report to City Council on an annual basis to present their financials, but they have an executive director and a board who oversees things, so.
And I understand they have a bit of a history that we've written about before.
Yeah, so we, predating my time here at The Spectator, the last story I think we did looking into this was in 2015. Steve Buse did a story, and it was looking at a lot of things, but sort of primarily that since 2007 up until that point, so that was April, I believe, of 2015, the trust had lost about $2.5 million over that time. So they have no money left from that initial seed money that they started with. And they had, you know, lost this money in addition through really net losses every year. And so it was looking, really looking at those figures and from, you know, the initial look that we've taken at the year-end figures since then for 2014 and 2015, it appears they're still losing money. You know, last year it was around the $400,000 mark for the year. And just to add, I mean, in speaking to counselors, Counselor Jason Farr about this, he says he likens the trust to you know, recreational service, and he says, you know, we don't expect recreational services to make money, and he thinks, you know, it's interesting that we do expect that of the trust, or expect them to break even.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of good, outstanding questions and issues here still to investigate. So looking forward to your future stories on this.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.